Welcome to Behind the Panels Issue 5, the only comic book podcast where our weakness is the color yellow. I'm your host, Richard Gray.
And I'm your co-host, David McVeigh. How many of those do you actually have, Richard?
723.
We're going to keep going until you run out of them. How's that sound?
All right. Yep.
That sounds like a plan.
It may be a little less than 723, so we may be over sooner than you think.
I just want to say congratulations, Richard. We have actually got quite a successful podcast on our hands.
So you've been telling me. I'm very pleased that people are listening to our weekly ramblings.
Considering that we're still a beta show that is kind of changing every episode at this point, I'm very impressed. So thank you,
and
everybody.
We have a weakness to yellow.
And we have a weakness to yellow.
I've never understood that, by the way.
No. Well, I do know.
Well, now we do because of the whole parallax.
They've explained it all. I still think it's really stupid. Let's put it that way.
At least it's not wood.
And for those who don't know what we're talking about, Green Lantern's weakness is that his green doesn't work on yellow, which just is silly.
It'd fail in Australia because they're virtually our national colors.
Yes. Well, and yeah, our sports colors are green and gold, aren't they?
Yep.
We've given them a problem. All right, Richard, this is issue 5. What do we got going on this week?
Look, we're going to keep the news up front really short this week. We've got a couple of bits of comic news and some movie news. It's quite exciting. But we're also our big issue or big reading assignment this week. Did you complete it, David?
I did. I did.
It was an awesome reading assignment, too.
It was 13 issue, volume 1 of The Ultimates. And it was a lot of fun going back. It's actually my second time through. And I really, really enjoyed it this time through.
Yeah, no, look, given the distance of it, I mean, it was always a good read, but it's even more powerful now, I think, having been through, you know, several years of Marvel Cinematic Universe as well, because that's really made us look at these in a whole different light. And there's a few little gags in there that I'll reference later that kind of came true in the Cinematic Universe.
Well, it's really interesting because you can, with reading The Ultimates, you can actually see a lot of the inspirations for the films. They haven't gone completely Ultimates universe for the films, but you can see they're borrowing from both universes, the standard Marvel timeline. And, like, I mean, let's face it, Nick Fury.
Sam Jackson.
Nick Fury is straight from The Ultimates.
Absolutely.
Anyway, we'll come back to that in the second half of the show, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But you've got a great article here from Newsarama that I want to talk about.
Yeah, well, I only wanted to look at this one quickly because I thought it'd be a good discussion point. And we've spoken in the past about how Justice League, the new 52 Justice League, was one of the highest selling issues this year, mm-hmm. and one of the biggest selling issues of all time. So Newsarama have put up the 10 best single issue comics of the past, best selling issues of the last 10 years. Now, these are just single issues
right.
that have sold well. So this is not collections, they're not graphic novels or anything like that, because a lot of graphic novels make it onto the New York Times bestseller lists.
Mm-hmm.
But these are just the single units, and they range from having sold 240,000 issues to about 500,000 issues.
Right, okay.
At the top end. So I'll run through these quickly.
Okay. I'm curious to know how many of these I've read.
Yeah, no, I've read a couple of them, but yeah, no, there's a few I've missed as well. So this one could have been one more of its 244,000 sales. It was Superman number 204, which came out back in 2004.
Oh, okay.
And it was
that's the Geoff Johns run, isn't it?
It was Jeff Loeb, actually.
Oh, Jeff Loeb, okay.
It wasn't. It was Brian Azzarello, Jim Lee, and Scott Williams.
Wow, way off the mark.
Yeah, no, I wasn't even close there. I got Jeff Loeb because in the article it mentions that Jim Lee had just collaborated with Jeff Loeb on the 12-issue Batman arc Hush.
Right.
And following the success of that, they put him on Superman, and that became one of the highest selling issues of the year as well, and indeed of the last 10 years.
Oh, okay.
Now, number 9 was a series I've not read yet, which is House of M, number 1.
I've read House of M. House of M is an interesting series. The basic premise of it is that Scarlet Witch, who always was one of the most dorky superheroes in history, because her mutant ability was to be able to affect probability. So. So basically, she could basically, with her mutant powers, wave her hand or whatever she did to make it activate, and she could change the outcome of something. You know, so if they were losing, she could, you know, swing the odds back in the favor of their winning. It was always a really dorky
That's lame.
It was. But what they did was they actually managed to make her a compelling character because, A, she was the sister of Pietro, what's his name again? The fast guy. He's
Quicksilver.
Quicksilver, thank you. My God, my brain went to jelly for a second.
And he appears in our pick of the week this week.
He does. And they've done something very interesting with those duo, because that's also that's Scarlet Witch as well, and we'll come back to that because that's a very odd subplot. But and then later in the series in the Marvel Universe, they started to then mention that these twins, or these brother and sister of Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver, were the children of Magneto, and so that added to all the drama of these two characters. Now, she was a member of the Avengers for a long time. Then she, with all the mutant stuff, became a mutant, so that she was in the X-Men world, you know, and all this sort of stuff. But what was happening was they decided that as she was going on, her powers were becoming stronger. And she was kind of losing control. And so she was basically manipulating reality because of her powers. And it got to a point where she was getting incredibly dangerous, because if she slipped at all in, you know, her mental capacity, she could basically turn the entire world on its head, you know, with what she could make it happen. And so there were all these talks, and this is in the main Marvel storyline, and this is what House of M is about, where the Avengers and the X-Men and everybody get together and basically say, what are we going to do about her? Because she is a danger to the planet, and she's a danger to everything around her. And so they kind of come to this consensus that they might have to basically put her down, you know, because she's so dangerous. She kind of gets wind of all this, and I'm kind of paraphrasing the whole thing. She kind of gets wind of all this, and in one fell swoop manages to alter reality to the point where everyone has superpowers, basically. Everyone is a mutant. And it becomes this entire world where mutants are the majority, and people with non-powers are a minority. And Magneto is basically the king of the world, and it's the House of M, you know what I mean, that rules this world. And it's one by one, heroes are starting to wake up to this alternate reality, going, this isn't our world. And what's going on here? It's a fascinating miniseries. I don't know if I completely either... I don't want to say understood, because I did understand it, but the ending is kind of convoluted.
Right.
And it kind of paints itself into a corner. But I can understand why issue one was so popular, because issue one is fascinating.
Well, it sold almost 250,000 copies.
Yeah, I can understand that entirely. It's like Fear itself. It started strong and kind of wimps out in the end, you know?
Yeah, well, what did sell 250,000 copies was number 8. It was Justice League of America number 1. Now, this is not the recent reboot. This is the second most recent reboot. this was back in 2006.
My head hurts.
I know. This is back in 2006, and Brad Meltzer did this relaunch. And this is his Identity Crisis number 1, which was this mini-series that they did where my boy Green Arrow was one of the leads in it. But he wrote this mini-series that was a great little mini-series in within the DCU. But that would have been in the top 10, but this has apparently bumped it out of the top 10. So same author, Brad Meltzer, who was a New York Times best-selling novelist, but has now written a bunch of DC comics. So it's good to see mainstream writers coming on board for comics as well. Absolutely. So that was number 8. That sold 250,000 copies. That was the second most recent reboot of Justice League.
Right.
Now, number 7 on the list is Justice League number 1, the one that came out back in August for the New 52.
Right, so
that sold 255,000 copies. And so that's definitely the easily the biggest selling comic this year, and number 7 of the last 10 years.
Wow.
So that's how big the New 52 is. Number 6, though, is back on Marvel, Secret Invasion number 1.
I've never read Secret Invasion. Actually.
No, nor have I. Mm. And
we might have to put
that's
this on the list.
Yeah, well, there you go. So we're not one of the 262,975 issues sold.
That's a Brian Bendis as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, apparently it started when New Avengers 31, there was the reveal that Elektra had been replaced by a Skrull.
Mm-hmm.
And it all went on from there.
You've got to love the Skrulls. They just throw the Skrulls in whenever they can.
Absolutely.
And in fact, feature in the book we're talking about this today.
number 5 on the list is Infinite Crisis number 1.
Right.
So this was the the last big crisis that not the last big crisis. I think there was Final Crisis after that.
Yeah.
Infinite Crisis is in 2005, and I think since then they've had Final Crisis.
You got to ask yourself, how many times can the DC universe go into crisis?
Well, they had Final Crisis, and to be fair, after that, they didn't have another crisis. They had Flashpoint.
Yeah, but at least it wasn't Flashpoint Crisis.
No, exactly. Well, they couldn't call it Crisis, so they'd already had their Final Crisis.
That's right. Well, that didn't stop Final Destination, but that's a whole
different
story. I wonder
if it's like a universe has a psychiatrist. I'm having another crisis.
Now, universe, sit down on the couch and tell me your problems.
I keep rebooting myself every 13 issues. Number four on this list isn't surprising. All-Star Batman and Robin the Boy Wonder, number one.
I haven't read this series.
I've read the first few issues and it never grabbed me, but this is set outside of traditional DC continuity. So it's kind of a crack at like what Marvel did with the Ultimate line.
Right, so it's a sandbox.
This one was, what was that?
It's a sandbox.
It's a sandbox, and it's written by Frank Miller and Jim Lee, right. And with art by Jim Lee. So yeah, I can understand why that sold really well, because it's Frank Miller back on board Batman for the first time in years.
But with a better artist.
And with that artist as well. He was hot in July 2005, so... And still is. Number three ties in nicely with what we're talking about this week, well, a little bit anyway. It's Captain America number 25 from back in March 2007. I'm sure you can guess which issue this was.
Oh, yes. This is the end of the Civil War.
This is the death of the dream issue.
Yeah,
so.
This was an amazing issue. If anybody hasn't read Civil War, I do encourage, and my son is just going, oh no, because he's actually reading Civil War at the moment. This is kind of a spoiler. Look, Civil War is, I think it's 100. The actual Civil War series itself is one of those limited series. It's only like 6 or 7 issues or whatever it is. I can't remember. But it is so many tie-in issues that if you actually read it from beginning to end with all tie-ins, I think it's like 129 issues or something like that to really... the entire Marvel universe basically goes to war with itself, and it was an amazing, amazing series.
I should say that number two then on that note is Civil War.
Yeah, well, there you go.
apparently, any single issue in that thing, they've just picked number two here for their list.
Yep.
But apparently, in a pure top 10, Civil War would take spots number two, number three, number four, number six, number seven, and number nine on the list.
I'm not surprised.
But they consolidated them just for the purpose of it not being the Civil War.
Because I think why it was so amazing was that they so perfectly captured the tone and mood of what was going on in the real world. And what you had was, you've got government, basically the whole idea of, you know, if you were even suspected of something, you would be jailed, and everybody was being, it was basically you're going on to, could you draw the analogy basically to a sex offenders list? If you were a superhero, you had to register and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
You know? And it was it's an amazing,
doubt there were ties into terrorism and all that.
Exactly.
Sort of
thing. And that's what I was saying. The parallels to what was actually going on in the real world, at that time, and you could sit there and go, yeah, Marvel's really struck a nerve here. They've put it into their world.
Well, this actually brings us nicely to number one on the list, having sold 530,000 copies.
Oh, no.
is Amazing Spider-Man number 583, which made its way onto the list because it got mainstream media coverage, much like Captain America number 25. And the reason it's because it features a backup story with Barack Obama.
I know. I'm looking at them. It's got Barack Obama with his thumb up on the front cover. It's like, oh, no.
And Spidey saying there. It's one of those old-fashioned covers where there's like a little speech bubble on the cover.
Yeah, I can't read it. That's too small. I've got to find this issue now. Actually, what issue is it? Oh, wait a minute. I might be able to look this up. Hold on a second.
Amazing Spider-Man number 583. So, yeah, it was a backup story where they actually had Barack Obama in it. So it wasn't the main story, but he did make the cover, as you said, with a massive thumb.
It's actually really cheesy. Alan, I might have it here. I might be able to look it up.
Here we go. Here, I've got it here. Hey, if you get to be on my cover, can I be on the dollar bill?
Spider-Man? No, they didn't. No, you didn't.
They did. So there you have it, the top 10 best-selling single-issue comics of the past 10 years.
Well, there you go. I think that's look, there's a couple of really good things in there.
Given that issue beat out the one before it by 200,000 issues, I would imagine that it's probably going to be, for quite some time, will be on the top of the list.
Well, I'm just having a look here and I'm going, okay, Superman 204 I haven't read, but House of M I have. And I'm looking here and I'm saying number 8, Justice League number 1 I haven't. Justice League of America number 1 I haven't. But Justice League number 1 I have. So that's what, 3?
So. Yeah, well, I've read all the DC stuff with the exception of Superman 204. So I've read Justice League of America 1 and Justice League number 1, that's 2. I've read Infinite Crisis is 3, All-Star Batman is 4. Haven't read Captain America, haven't read, you know, I've only read 3 of them myself, so.
I've read 5 of them.
Well, there you go.
I got 5 under my belt on that
list. Marvel's is better represented in this list than DC, yeah. And I've stated many times in the past, I'm more of a DC boy.
I'm more the Marvel, so that makes sense. But it's actually very interesting that out of that top 10 that Marvel is so heavily represented there.
Mm. And I think but Marvel has been selling better over the last few years. And I think that's what was so important about the New 52 is that it did put so many DC titles back in the charts again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why we talked about that a few weeks ago. I mean, that's why it's so important. But I think we should move swiftly along. I think it's time for some movie news.
Oh, wait. No, you caught me off guard. Caught me off guard, dude.
There you are. So that look at how smooth this show runs, people.
I know, it's so
that's
good.
That's why we're doing so.
It's
well.
Like it's got WD-40 all over it.
I'm going to save the best for last. So let's talk about Booster Gold.
Okay, let's talk about Booster Gold. Booster Gold. I don't know if we've talked about him much on this show or not. But
we have a little bit in the sense that he's been a bit absentee from.
Oh, we did mention that he's in the New 52 in Justice League International.
National, that's right. And but maybe we're yet to touch on whether or not he has any insight into this being a time traveler.
Now, he did make an appearance, and apparently quite a well-rated appearance, in the last season of Smallville. He appeared in the last... He played, and funnily enough, fighting Blue Beetle. So there you go. They were introducing people right, left, and center in the last season of Smallville, and it almost felt like we were in the 80s again. You know how in the 80s we had things like in the Incredible Hulk movies they would introduce Daredevil because they're hoping they could spin Daredevil off into his own series. And they always failed attempts, and it felt like with the last season of Smallville, it's like, how many heroes can we throw in here that might spark off into something else? And nothing seemed to hold. But now it looks like... now, sci-fi or sci-fi or however you want to pronounce this. Luckily in Australia, it's just called sci-fi still, but in America, they changed the spelling. The Sci-Fi Channel is going to bring Booster Gold to the small screen.
Yay.
Now, my question is, what sort of budget are we looking at here? Because Booster Gold's got some serious superpowers.
Well, look, you know, and I think this is one of the things that the people were complaining about when it was taking a while for any... follow-ups to happen to Smallville. And one of the chief reasons was given was that Smallville was an expensive show to make.
Yeah.
And after 10 years is a huge run.
Absolutely.
For any show, given how hard it is to get any science fiction show off the ground for more than a year and a half at the moment. We've seen all the tent poles collapse in the last few years. We've got Stargate's gone. We've seen there's no Star Trek on the small screen anymore.
Well, the only decent sci-fi the only decent big budget sci-fi on television would be Terra Nova, and that's getting lukewarm ratings at the moment.
Exactly, and they're expensive to produce. Is the problem with sci-fi? So it'll be interesting to see what they do with this. As you said, it'd be an expensive prospect if they don't do it. Don't do a completely watered down for
sure. I'm looking here, and it says here that it's going to be brought to us by Greg Berlanti's Productions.
Yes, and Andrew Kreisberg is one of the people involved as well.
Well, I thought it was interesting that one of Berlanti's credits as a producer is No Ordinary Family, which was that superhero series last year.
This is Green Lantern as well, and I don't know whether that's...
I would imagine that's the new animated series, which I actually saw the pilot episode the other day.
I haven't looked at that yet, so
jury's out.
Okay,
We'll talk about that next week. I think we'll put that out. I think we'll try and get you to see it, and we might have a talk about that next week because I think the jury is out on that. I think Nicholas and I were both a little bit kind of like, it's okay. It's actually all CG. which I didn't realize. It's not the Bruce
Timm. It's not the Bruce Timm kind of stuff.
It's not the Bruce Timm crowd. And that's a bit of a mistake, I think. But anyway, we'll talk about that more next week. But I think it's fascinating that he actually produced No Ordinary Family. So the Green Lantern that he's produced, I assume, is this new series. It's the only Green Lantern around, so I assume.
It says television, so I'm guessing that's it,
yeah. And No Ordinary Family got cancelled after one season. So how much?
And Kreisberg's other stuff includes Warehouse 13 and Red Faction Origins. So,
Red Faction Origins was that one-off telly movie.
Yeah.
Which I still haven't seen. Warehouse 13's quite successful, though.
It's been doing well. So, yeah. So, look, I mean, it has the potential to be good, and I think we do need more attempts at sci-fi anyway, and Booster Gold could just be a sleeper hit.
Now, the Booster Gold is all going to be dependent on who they cast, because Booster Gold's supposed to be that, you know, million-dollar smile and the real... he's supposed to be, you know, he's got to look like a superstar. You know what I mean?
Maybe the guy that played Green Arrow could have another crack at the spin-off. Because they've already tried him as Aquaman.
Yeah, they tried him as Aquaman. Brought him on as Green Arrow. What's he doing now? He's got nothing on his plate.
He's got nothing on. He could play Booster Gold.
Absolutely. Actually, they could just about bring about half the cast of Smallville over.
Yeah, why not?
I don't
not?
Think anybody's doing anything from that show, are they?
No, I don't think so. Certainly not Tom Welling.
Now, the one thing that Greg Berlanti's got going for him is he's also one of the producers from that Sally Field series, Brothers and Sisters, which is... Now, what, it's been cancelled now, but it ran four seasons or three seasons, and it was quite successful. So he might have a bit of clout on that. He's not going to have much clout from No Ordinary Family. But did you see No Ordinary Family?
No, I haven't, actually.
It was actually kind of fun. It never quite sold itself, but it was basically about a family that got superpowers, and they didn't know what to do with them. And, like, the father wanted to go out and fight crime, but he was afraid of getting in trouble by his wife. It had Michael Chiklis in it. And he had super strength, and one of his daughter was psychic, and his wife had super speed. It's a bizarre concept. So anyway, but
we'll move swiftly along. Now, do we have some Batman music we can play here?
We can do something here. How about? Oh God, where are we? Well, I don't have any music, but we could do this.
Can you do me a favor? I want you to tell all your friends about me.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
There you go.
That'll do.
That'll do. I don't have Batman on the board. Where was it? It was on the board last week.
Oh, look, McVeigh, you failed me twice this issue.
I know. God, I'm not on the ball. All right, Empire Batman. Man.
Okay. The Dark Knight Rises, little movie coming out next year.
Just a little one.
Just a tiny little movie.
Indie film, I believe.
It's a sequel, the third part, the end of a trilogy, if you will, to two other small little films, Batman Begins and The Dark Knight.
Oh, they were just little art house things.
Nobody saw them.
No. Indie productions.
Indie productions.
I think Gus Van Sant
director Christopher Nolan's never made a big film. But he is making a big film next year called The Dark Knight Rises, which is going to be the conclusion to his Batman trilogy. And... Empire magazine came out this week in the UK and had a few good new images of Batman holding what I can only imagine looks like a speed camera, a speed gun. You know, when the police hold up the speed gun camera things, that's what it looks like to me. Anyway,
I saw the pictures of Bane from the cover.
And they look very, very cool. And there's a little bit of information in this story as to explaining what all that stuff on his face is about. Now, we say it every issue. Spoiler central here, so if you don't want to know anything about the new Batman movie, tune out now.
I believe we have a spoiler sound. There we go.
There you are. But as we've said every time, if you're listening to the show, assume there will be spoilers. Now, Christopher Nolan revealed a little bit about the timeline of the film, which I thought was really interesting. He said this is going to be set much later than The Dark Knight, and I'm going to quote him directly here. He said, "It's really all about finishing Batman and Bruce Wayne's story. We left him in a very precarious place. Perhaps surprisingly for some people, our story picks up quite a bit later, 8 years after The Dark Knight. So he's an older Bruce Wayne. He's not in a great state." Now, I thought that was really interesting, and I hadn't heard that bit of news before.
That's almost treading in Frank Miller territory.
That's what I thought. And at the end of The Dark Knight, I've said to a few people, you know what would be really cool? If they set the next one way after and did kind of a Dark Knight Frank Miller sort of thing.
It also kind of makes sense in that teaser trailer now when Jim Gordon says, "You left us."
Yeah.
You know, and he's all beaten up in the hospital bed and he says, "You left us," you know, and I think that it kind of really sells that moment a bit more now, knowing that he's been gone for so long.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's some load of potential there, and I think that's what you really needed. If you're going to do another the Batman movie, you have to really take a break from those previous two.
You
really have to thematically break from that and give it its whole new world. And what's really interesting here is that they're talking a little bit about Tom Hardy as Bane as well,
mm-hmm.
who, which we know, of course, in the comics from the Nightfall saga, was the character that broke Batman's back.
Absolutely.
And left Bruce Wayne incapacitated. So putting those two pieces of information together, we can imagine this might be the end of Bruce Wayne. But on Bane himself, what I found was really interesting. He says, with Bane, we were looking to give Batman a challenge he hasn't had before. With our choice of villain and our choice of story, we're testing Batman both physically as well as mentally. He goes on to say he's brutal, he's a big dude, he's incredibly clinical. In fact, he's got a results-based and oriented fighting style, yada, yada, yada. Anything from small joint manipulation to crushing skulls, crushing creatures, stamping on shins and knees and necks and collarbones and snapping heads off and tearing his fists through chests, ripping out spinal columns. He's a terrorist in mentality as well as in brutal action.
Charming man.
Sounds like a kitten lover.
Absolutely.
But just sort of still on Bane, I thought it was really interesting. The costume designer, Lindy Hemming, let slip a few tidbits about the costume that we've been seeing. Now, we've seen a lot of Bane's costume so far, probably more detailed shots of Bane's costume than anything else, I think, that's come out so far.
Yeah, well, the cat got out of the bag with all the leaked set photos.
That's
and so
right.
They've started to release stuff.
They've actually released a few, as we know, official photos of Bane with a close-up of that big mask thing that's on his face.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Lindy Hemming has said, he said he was injured early in the story. He's suffering from pain and needs gas to survive. He can't survive the pain without the mask. The pipes from the mask go back along his jawline and feed into the thing on his back where there are two canisters.
Mm-hmm.
So they've built in, they've tried to make this. Now, I think that's interesting. It's what they've done is taken the bit of the Bane lore, which was I think that was the venom stuff that was pumping into his veins in the comic.
Which gave him kind of enhanced strength.
Now, this is Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight world, which is very meant to be grounded in reality. Now, I think this is pushing the boundaries a little bit of that being grounded in reality, but at least it sort of follows that philosophy of everything on screen is there for a purpose.
Yeah.
And this is aesthetically very cool.
Well, it means that he's more tolerant to pain because he's on a perpetual flow of painkillers, which is going to make him a lot. It's kind of making your lead bad guy basically hopped up on PCP the whole time.
It's PCP, exactly. Yeah. And I was just thinking exactly that. And so I think that's good. And the new photos that they've got out of Bane, that there's the it was a cover that was released just for Empire subscribers.
Right.
It's just a black cover with Bane crossing his arms on the cover, and Tom Hardy looks ripped.
He does. He's looking like he's gone from the Warrior, you know, the film where he's the fighter, and then just gone, let's pump up even more. You know?
A little worried for Tom Hardy.
And it's so funny when you think about what a fey character he was in Inception. You must learn to dream a little bit larger, darling. And you sit there and go, really? That's Bane now. My God.
So, but Tom Hardy, marvelous actor. So if anyone can pull this off, it's Tom Hardy.
I have all faith in him.
I have all faith in this movie. I think this may be possible. Look, you know, let's not hype it up too much, but I think we're all holding out. It's going to be the great, what I hope. It could be one of the greatest Batman films.
And it's got big shoes to fill.
It's got very big shoes to fill, but look, you know, it's got the same creative forces behind it, and it's got one of the best. Looks like they're combining two of the best Batman stories of the last 20 years. So.
And they've got what's her name, Catwoman? What's her name? Give me a second. Anne Hathaway in a skin tight cat suit. Come on,
sold,
and you got a flying tank.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm digging it.
After that stuff.
I mean, we saw the Batwing leaked footage online, and it just looks like the Tumblr that flies.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with any of that sentence.
None of it at all. All right. Let's do this pick of the week. What do you reckon?
Let's do it, boy.
Well, see how you like this.
What is it, Batman?
Whatever it is, it's awfully funny.
It's the pick of the week.
All right,
it
Richard.
It definitely is.
It is. Hit me with it.
And the pick of the week this week, as we've already said, is the first 13 issues of The Ultimates, or The Ultimates Volume 1.
Absolutely. Written by Mark Millar.
And with art by Brian Hitch.
Absolutely. Mark Millar, for those who should remember from last week's episode, is the creator of Kick-Ass.
Exactly right. Now, a little bit of background, I guess we should just give to The Ultimates universe. It was Marvel's reboot. Not reboot series, that's completely wrong. It's Marvel's sandbox series. So sandbox, they allowed... Yeah. They rebooted the universe in its own little pocket corner with books Ultimate Spider-Man and Ultimate X-Men.
Well, and I remember an interview going way back when it all started, when the Ultimates started, when the Ultimate Universe started, I should say, when they basically said they wanted to... It's exactly the same mentality as the New 52 with DC. They said there are a lot of people who would like to start reading comics because of the popularity of movies and so forth, and just couldn't get in because it's too much history. And they said, let's reboot or create a rebooted series, which is basically it contemporizes it into the modern world right now. What would happen if it all started now?
Exactly, and they all these books were like, you know, several hundred issues in at this point. So yeah, it was definitely needed to have some sort of accessible book for the masses. But the Ultimates was, I think, the third series that came out of that.
Yep.
The first two, as I've already said, being Spider-Man and X-Men.
Yep.
Now, Spider-Man is excellent. X-Men, it took a lot longer to get going, I think. And Spider-Man was Brian Michael Bendis.
Yeah, Spider-Man was really faithful, too, though. I mean, it was a really... Yeah. They didn't go outrageously different with the costumes or anything. They just basically said, let's put him back in high school, let's give him a restart, and just kick it off again.
And, you know, to put it into context, this is around the time that the Spider-Man movies were in development as well, the first of them, and then they actually came out during the run. So... That was a big impetus for a lot of people to start reading, and it was a good book for people to jump on board because it was very much the character that was appearing in the movies, at least the first movie, because Peter Parker was still in high school and all that sort of thing. So
absolutely, yeah.
Which brings us, anyway, flash forward a few years, it brings us to The Ultimates. Now, The Ultimates is, for those of you not familiar with the Marvel Universe at all or haven't seen any of the Marvel movies, is basically the Avengers.
Yes. Which actually threw me a little bit because the first one I read, going back a few years, the first one I read was Ultimate Avengers because I went, okay, I'll read the Ultimate Avengers because I like the Avengers. And I went, what the hell am I reading? I said, where are all my superheroes? Because it didn't have Captain America and it didn't have all the superheroes that we wanted. And then I, you know, had to delve into it and dig down and I found out that the Ultimate Avengers actually came later. And the initial Avengers, or in the Ultimates universe anyway, was the Ultimates. And I went, okay, that's where we start then. And I don't see. I was a big Marvel boy. You weren't. And I sat down, and I remember when the first time I read the Ultimates, I actually didn't like it.
And it's interesting you should say that because as a non-Marvel person, and I'll just say this up front. The Ultimates was a book that actually got me interested in these characters.
Oh, see, that's interesting, because when I actually read it...
So it did its job.
Well,
its job
exactly. And for me, being a Marvel person, I'm going, these aren't my superheroes. Why are they acting like this? Why do they look like that? Why are they doing this? Why is Nick Fury black?
Yeah, exactly. This book was written for people like me who'd always wanted to read... an Avengers book or a Marvel Universe book. It didn't know where to start.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a great starting point.
It's brilliant. And like you, I read this for the second time, maybe even the third time this week. I read them when they originally came out. But it means a lot more now. And of course, now that, you know, in the last half decade or so since this came out, I've read a lot more Marvel stuff, and I'm a lot more familiar with the universe, also through the movies as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it has a lot more impact, and as we'll see as we go through, there's a lot of references in there that ultimately either directly influence the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or actually just slightly ironic given the direction of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Well, let's address one of those right up front, which is of course Nick Fury, because this is where we introduce the bald black Nick Fury with the eye patch, who is drawn strikingly similar to Samuel L. Jackson.
So similar, in fact.
There is actually a line in the book where they say, "If a movie was made of us, who would play you?" And he went, "Samuel L. Jackson, of course." And I just went, now, I mean, okay, this is we're talking, what, 8 years before a movie was even talked about. But you can sit there and go, they're all sitting there going, yeah, that's who we want to play.
And so I remember when Fury first turned up in now, which movie was it?
Iron Man 1. At the end of Iron Man 1, yeah.
And I remember sitting there just thinking, yep. You got that right.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I'd like to point out, just on a side note, now, this is completely ridiculous, I know, but I just, it's caught my eye and I have to bring it up. Did you see who the editor was of The Ultimates?
No, I'm going back to the title page now. It's Ralph Macchio.
Now, I don't think it's the same
one. It's not, but jokes have been made for years. It's not the same Ralph Macchio.
Wax on, wax off. No, I'm staring at a title page right now and I'm going, Ralph Macchio, really? All right, let's.
Who has been a Marvel editor for some years now. He's not, and his Wikipedia interested. He's not related to the actor Ralph Macchio, but he's nicknamed Karate Kid after the actor's famous.
Oh, very good, very good. All right, so the Ultimates actually kicks off, of course, in the 40s, and it kicks off with Captain America going on a mission and doing what Captain America does well, you know, and stopping the threat of the Nazis getting nuclear weapons, which also kind of throws me straight off the bat because you go, what book am I reading?
Yeah. And but, it was a ballsy move to actually start this brand new launch of their superhero series for a new generation in the 1940s.
Yeah, it is. And it kind of throws you. The one thing I will say about The Ultimates, now, say this up front right now, is that I love the artwork in it.
Oh, it Brian Hitch's artwork is beautiful.
It's beautifully drawn, really highly detailed. I love the fact that all of the expressions on people's faces are very clear. That it doesn't leave a lot of ambiguity in the frames. It's a really beautiful-looking book. I mean,
and then just as you're getting comfortable with the narrative you're going through, suddenly you turn the page and there's a beautiful big double-page splash. And he does these really great big splash pages of this beautiful action-packed artwork. And there's one in the first issue in the 1940s, where they're first invading the base, and there are planes flying. There's explosions.
Yeah. I've got the page open right now. It's beautiful with the explosion and the GIs running in the foreground and stuff like that.
It's just so, as you said, so beautifully detailed.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic, and they keep that. They maintain that art quality all the way through the first volume, which is just beautiful. But it's really interesting because we go from that and we have basically them stopping this threat and Captain America doing something really ballsy and brave. And I love the fact that Captain America, what?
I was going to say, doing something ballsy and brave. I mean, one of his earliest lines was something along the lines of parachutes if it wimps.
Yes. And then we've got that beautiful full page shot of him going charging and saying, what are we waiting for, ladies, Christmas?
I've got that page open now, yeah.
And I love the fact that he's got his stars. It's very much like the movie, but he's got all the GI stuff on him. You know, he's got the water bottle and the machine gun and the helmet. You know, and he's just charging in there. And then this is the classic, and what I think is really interesting is we've actually summarized the entire origin story of Captain America really in the space of, 20 pages or something like that, and then shift from that point into our modern era after the explosion goes off and Captain America's lost, you know, and you go, oh, what a shame he's lost, and that's it. And then we cut to the mountains.
Yeah.
And what a shot. I mean, it's just this beautiful painting of Everest. And, of course, it's Tony Stark. And I love the fact that Tony Stark is such a lush in this. I mean, he's always been a lush. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, Demon in a Bottle is a very famous Iron Man run in the original Iron Man line. But in the Ultimates, they've gone just that step further. They've made – it's like he just doesn't care about anything. But they've also painted him that he's such a genius. So what is the? I think it's like down in like issue 9 or something like that, further down the track. There's one point where they're saying, what must it be like to be Tony Stark? He's, you know, sorting out two international companies, balancing his checkbook, picking up three ladies or whatever, and he's flying his Iron Man suit all at the same time.
Yeah, you know? That's right. It is much later in the series. I remember that line. And I remember thinking about that at the time. And yeah, and they do paint him very much as the line from the Avengers trailer, which I'm sure we've all memorized by now, which is billionaire, playboy, philanthropist, genius, you know.
Now, we should be clear that the movies borrow a lot from the Ultimates worlds.
Absolutely.
But we also have stuff from the main timeline. So they're not, the movies aren't the Ultimates, which is interesting, because that's what I would have just assumed that they would have gone with. Because I kind of sometimes feel like Marvel's real focus is in the Ultimates line right now. Because
it seems to be.
Because they really like the reboot and everything, but they've kept the other timelines open. But there is stuff from those other timelines in the movies as well. So it's kind of like a merging of the two worlds. But there is a lot to be kept, such as in this series, we've got the what is effectively the Avengers being brought together by S.H.I.E.L.D. They're not an organic team. They are a hired team, you know, and they are basically on government payrolls to do what they have to do, which is very much what we're heading for in the movie by the looks of it.
And as we find out throughout the comic, S.H.I.E.L.D., which is pretty much Nick Fury and Hawkeye,
that's right,
in a shed for a couple of years.
I love the fact that they introduce Hawkeye by saying, you know, is that washed up athlete around somewhere? You know?
Yeah.
It's like he's just an archer from the Olympics, you know. It's
like, when we finally see him in action, we see him as an Ultimate, for sure.
Absolutely. And I think it's really interesting that for a comic book that is called The Ultimates, which is basically about a team of superheroes, issue one is 25 pages of 1944 or whatever it is, and Captain America doing his thing, and 2 pages of Tony Stark on a mountain.
And that's it.
And that's it. And you sit there and go, where are the rest of them?
And you know what? This is something I'll say up front as well, which is this is a series that takes its time to get where it's going, and when it finally does pick up, it doesn't stop from that point onwards.
Absolutely.
Also, because of that pacing, it gives us time to get to know every single one of those characters. So by the time it does pick up, and if you stay with the Ultimate Marvel Universe, you will know that, and you said this before the show, David, that they don't have any qualms about killing off characters.
No, and that comes later. We're gonna probably revisit the Ultimate Universe in later shows. We're not gonna just keep rolling straight on, because the first thing that happened after I finished reading the 13 issues of Volume 1 was I immediately wanted to go on to Volume 2 because I was really hooked in this time.
And you know what? Well, these are characters you want to spend time with.
Absolutely. You want to know what's going to happen, because they are on a precarious place. They are on government money, and there's a lot of internal problems. And we're going to come to that, because this delves into some dark territory in places.
Very dark territory. And I think at the time, Mark Millar might have actually described this. He said he described the pacing of the series as like an HBO series.
Yeah, very good. I like that. Because it's very true.
And the reason he said that is that's why he did them in 13 issue arcs.
Yeah.
So you had series one, series two, series three, effectively. So you've got that, and so that's why you kind of spend. A lot may not happen for one issue, but it's just a character issue.
It is a drama piece. I mean, let's delve into that one piece of drama, the one core piece of drama that happens in this, which is of course Hank Pym or Henry Pym, who is of course Giant Man. Later to become Ant-Man. But at the moment he's playing around with the Giant Man formula. We should say straight off the bat that there have been changes to some of these heroes. So if you are familiar with the Marvel Universe and haven't read the Ultimates or any of the Ultimate series, they have changed certain. Let's talk about that before we talk about Hank Pym. Let's talk about the changes to some of these characters. Captain America is pretty much the same.
More or less, yeah.
More or less. They've made him a little bit more turmoiled because he is a man out of time, and he has only just woken up. So he's still finding his place in the world. And I think there's a lovely scene where he's trying to get his little apartment together, and he's gone to flea markets to find old vinyl records and stuff to rebuild his life, and then gets robbed.
Yep.
You know, it's like, poor
shit. Oh, I love the reaction to that too. So who was it? The Russians? Or was it exactly. No, it was the guys across the street.
Cap's going over to beat him up now. and we've also got, as we've talked about, Tony Stark already, you know, and the change that they made to him. I love the fact that he's not entirely comfortable in the Iron Man suit.
And it doesn't work. It keeps malfunctioning.
I love the fact that every time he takes off his helmet, he's got like this green ooze all over him. Like he's got some sort of coolant on his body or something.
That's right.
And it's got its own little launch hangar and stuff like that. So it's not like this organic suit that he has that he just jumps into or keeps in a briefcase. It is actually like something he has to launch. You know what I mean? But I think one of the, and we should also talk about the Hulk. who they have drastically changed. He's still just Bruce Banner who gets mad and turns into a lumbering monster. But in the original Marvel timeline, the Hulk maintains a semblance of Banner's consciousness. And so he doesn't purposely go out and hurt people and stuff. He's usually beating up on bad people. You know what I mean? Because there is a core that Banner is still in there, not in the Ultimates. In the Ultimates, when the Hulk comes out to play, this one point where they're talking about he's chewing on people's like spinal columns and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh God, that's just gross. You know? It's like lay meat.
You know, and there's a lot of humor in there as well.
the shield
on one point where Captain America, and later in the series, Captain America is basically using Hulk's rage to help them take out the enemies. And he says, hey, those guys up there said you were a bit fancy. And he goes, Hulk straight!
Or later on, because he was chewing on the Skrulls, they're collecting his stool samples.
Right.
He ate some of those shapeshifters. We have to collect every bit
of them. And
they're
like, you're kidding, right? And the technician's like, no, I really wish I was.
And the container he's holding is this glowing green container. It's the twisted mind of Mark Millar.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. They've completely revamped Wasp.
Mm-hmm.
Janet Pym, they've turned her into a mutant to start with, which she never was in the first place.
Of course, the relationship between the Pyms is drastically
different. I want to come back to that. And once I hold that thought, they've made her Asian, which she never was. But they've kept her basic, you know, she shifts down into the little wasp and has little wasp stings. But they've made her kind of unsure of herself, whereas Janet Pym was always very assured. She was actually the leader of the Avengers at one point.
Well, they're also hinting in this, I'm not sure if this is true of the Marvel Universe, they're hinting in this that she may actually be a mutant.
No, that's only in the Ultimates Universe.
In the Ultimate Universe, yeah. So they're hinting that not only is she a mutant, that Hank Henry Pym has cheated a little bit by getting government funding by claiming her mutant powers as the result of his experiments.
That's right. His entire Giant Man, Ant-Man growth and shrink formula is based on her blood.
Yes.
Yeah. And so he's genius, but he's kind of just shortcutted it.
He's a piece of work.
He is a piece of work. And then we've got the subplot between her and him. And I just want to put a little bit of time in on this because that was rough.
It is rough. It's probably one of the, and I don't even know if I completely agree with how rough that it went.
It definitely makes a point. I'm not entirely sure why that point was in the Ultimates, but it definitely makes a point.
But the thing is, what we're talking about is it's a domestic abuse subplot.
Mm.
And it was not enough. Like he hits Janet Pym in an issue, and that's enough to demonstrate that he's not the nicest of people. But of course, this explores what happens when superheroes have a domestic.
Mm.
She shrinks down to get away. He's not satisfied with that, so he not only does he spray her with insect repellent, is nasty.
And then she goes and hides under a piece of furniture, and he says, that's not good enough, you're not going to hide. So he puts on his Ant-Man helmet and commands the ants to come in and attack her en masse. And basically they say when she's in hospital later that it was only the fact that she actually grew to her full size was the only reason they could find her.
Yeah.
And she's suffering from anaphylactic shock from all the ant bites because she was tiny at the time. And it's like, and then he goes, of course, and goes on the run.
And the conclusion to that subplot is, of course, Captain America, being the Boy Scout that he is, doesn't like men who beat up women.
No. So he goes and looks for him.
Yeah. And there's a terrific scene where he actually takes down he beats Hank Pym until he turns into Giant Man, but then still manages to take him down with a terrific line, how big do you feel now?
Yeah. Well, I also love the fact that he's taunting Hank to grow. And he keeps saying,
come on. Give me something I can hit.
Give me something I can hit. He grows and says, is this big enough for you? And then Captain America proceeds to just bring down this giant. You know? Yeah. I love the fact that there's early on when the Hulk goes on his rampage, speaking of Captain America bringing down big guys, Captain America goes toe-to-toe with the Hulk, and that's pretty amazing too.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't.
This is a real beef Beefcake Captain America.
Yeah, this is one tough hombre. You know? And I love the fact that they keep referring to the steroids and stuff that he's on.
Well, yeah, the thing is that the Super Soldier Serum is mean stuff. Like, this is that they've actually created a non-green monster version of the Hulk is kind of what they're hinting at with Captain America.
Because they have Banner working on the Super Soldier formula.
Which is what turns him into the Hulk in the first place, a failed experiment there. Right. And when he Hulks out for the first time in this series, he actually crossbreeds his Hulk formula with some of Captain America's blood.
Hmm.
Making it this kind of super Hulk monster who's able to, who brings down Giant Man by climbing into his mouth. It's like forcing his jaw apart.
I love the fact that they send Janet Pym into the Hulk's ear canal.
Yeah.
To zap him on the inside of his head.
Because Janet Pym, when she's small, she's got this flat little insect sting thing.
Well, she can actually do that at full size, too. This is spoilers for what's coming up. In Ultimates 2 or 3, she actually does one at full size and blows the person off their feet.
Right.
So she just doesn't. There's some really interesting stuff coming up. If you haven't read Ultimates 2 and 3, there's some really interesting stuff that comes up later with these characters because there's a lot still to come. We should also mention that Black Widow is also a member of the team. And in this, she's actually cybernetically enhanced.
Yes.
And there's a real Matrix moment where she jumps between buildings with the rifle being thrown from a helicopter.
There's some terrific moments where that whole sequence where they're jumping between buildings actually gives you a really good showcase for why Hawkeye is on the team, first of all, because he's just, as they said, just a washed-up athletics guy.
But brutal.
And why she's on the team as well. Both really interesting characters, and obviously they've used Black Widow in both of those characters. They're using in the film version of the Avengers, and the lineup is pretty much the same as the Ultimates.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I think it's identical, in fact. The one person we haven't mentioned much is Thor.
Now, Thor was a really interesting turn, and they've actually gone for the film version of Thor. They've actually gone back to the J. Michael Straczynski run. Which was the Broxton, Oklahoma run, most recent run, which is probably a good move because the Thor that's in the Ultimates is actually kind of hard. He's a hard one to grasp. and it's actually really, really interesting. He's a really interesting character and I like him, but he's not my Thor.
No, actually, even I had problems because I love the Thor film so much, and that's my primary exposure to Thor, I have to admit. I found trouble getting into this version of Thor as well, whereas every other character is at least a little bit familiar to you, regardless of which incarnation of that character you've read.
That's right. They're familiar enough.
Yeah. Like, you know, the character in here, as you read it, if he wasn't ever going to be played by Robert Downey Jr., then they should have never made a film in the first place. exactly. Like that is, you know, he is written as someone that could have been Robert Downey Jr. It's interesting. They mention casting Johnny Depp when they're fictionally casting themselves in a film.
If they had said Robert Downey Jr., I would have fallen off my seat, I think.
Yeah.
I think it would have been too close. But what they've done
if you cast your mind back to 2002, Robert Downey Jr. wasn't back.
I think he was in jail, actually, in 2002.
Probably was, yeah.
But no. So what they've done with Thor here is they've made him a hippie activist, basically, who's going around doing things like destroying, you know, the Greenpeace ships and all this sort of stuff. And he has this magic hammer that is incredibly powerful, and that's why they recognize him. They say he's got an almighty hammer, you know, and they don't know where his powers come from, but he keeps saying that he's an Asgardian god, and they're all going, there's no such thing as Asgardian gods. And his history was he was actually in a mental institution.
And he said he didn't realize his origin until he was 13, which is, as far as they're concerned, when he had his first mental breakdown.
That's right. But they do decide that he is powerful enough that they need need his hitting power.
Because at this stage in the Ultimate, this is not this mega team that's coming together. This is a team that's struggling to even find its members.
Yeah, and a threat. Because they're saying we've got all this funding and there's been nothing to actually fight.
Yeah. And so they can't even keep them all in the same room long enough to have a super team. And it's really all about photo opportunities and press coverage.
And they've got Betty from, you know, the Hulk's girlfriend. They've got her as their publicist, you know, walking around doing their PR work, you know, and she's a complete bitch.
Absolutely.
But I love the fact that every time they go and approach Thor, he's like, yeah, you know, as soon as you've got that president out of the White House, I'll come back, you know, I'll come.
And what's really interesting about this is they actually had George W. Bush as the president.
You see him at one point when he's talking to Captain America.
And if I recall correctly, when Mark Millar was talking about that back when he wrote the thing, I think it was around the time it was released, he said he really wanted to have it grounded in our world because he said that would make it more instantly relatable. Because if you have to kind of introduce a president character and introduce his politics and introduce all that sort of stuff, that's a whole other story. But if you say, right, that's the president, you recognize who that is, you don't have to worry about it, you know what world they're operating in.
Yeah, it also sets them right in a place. I mean, it sets a time period as well.
And I suppose that's always been true of the main Marvel universe, where DC's always been set in Metropolis and Gotham City and Star City. You know, the Marvel universe was always set in New York City or...
Absolutely. That was actually a big factor about Marvel was the fact that they did ground it in a real world.
Yeah.
You know, whereas they always came up with analogs in DC, you know.
And they've maintained that and they've actually taken that to its logical extreme by actually making it our world. But just happens to have superheroes in it.
What's interesting about DC, though, is they've started to bring in the real world. Have you noticed this in the New 52?
They'll be
in Metropolis and they'll say, yeah, he's coming in from New York. So we've suddenly said, oh, Metropolis isn't New York now. Because we always kind of assumed that Metropolis was New York.
Well, it's funny, and this is just a bit of an aside. A few years ago they did a Marvel-DC crossover. And it was like Justice League versus the Avengers or something. I can't remember what it was called now, actually. But it was a big crossover between the worlds. And the Marvel people came over and said, their world looks pretty much like ours. The United States looks almost identical, except they've got a few extra cities on the east and west coasts. And that was the only reference they kind of made to it.
back to the Ultimates for a minute, because I just want to bring up the one line I love, where the Hulk is rampaging out in the city. And this was actually an interesting subplot as well, where Banner actually made himself Hulk out because he wanted to give them something to fight. Exactly. And so it was kind of way against protocol, but it put them on the newspaper headlines. But what I love is the fact that they go, we need to get Thor here because we need a heavy hitter. And he says, we've called Thor. He won't come unless the president doubles the international aid budget. And then halfway through the fight, this bolt of lightning comes down and they go, oh my, and Thor comes out with his hammer and belts him. And we cut back to the office and they go, message from the White House. General, president just doubled our international aid budget.
There's one page I took a screenshot from Thor related because I've taken a few pictures of the pages I wanted to have a look at. And one of them was Thor comes down to fight the Skrulls towards the end of the series. And it's like, sweet mother of God, I thought this guy was supposed to be a pacifist, man. And Thor says, a pacifist with a big scary hammer, General.
Yes, I love that.
But you mentioned before, this is something I just wanted to mention. I knew there was a Robert Downey Jr. reference somewhere in the book.
Yep.
And there is. He says, Captain America says, listen, I'm sorry about breaking your nose back there, General Fury. And Fury responds with, take it easy, Cap. This nose has been smashed more times than Robert Downey Jr. Now, there you go. There's a bit of prophetic wisdom.
There's your reference for you. Put it in there. So we've got
There's just other things I like in there where it's about the characters, like Giant Man. They're trying to get him to do a photo opportunity with some planes. They said, can you lift one of those planes just over your head for a photo? And he goes, look, to be honest, they actually look kind of heavy.
Yeah. It's just little
character touches like that I like. And one of my favorite lines in there, and they reference it directly later on, is during one of the big fights when the Skrull commander's trying to get Captain America to surrender, and he goes, surrender? You think this letter on my head stands for France?
And I love the fact that later in the series, when Fury's talking to him and he repeats the line, and he goes, that stuff cracks me up, man. And he goes, where'd you come up with that line? He goes, I don't know, came out in the heat of battle. So with this book, we've got two major action beats. first action beat is the Hulk going berserker beef and them having to take that down. And then we've got this plot that kind of brings the whole first volume full circle, because it brings back the Nazis from the 1944, who turned out not to be Nazis at all. They were Skrull alien shapeshifters. And of course, this makes it personal for Captain America. So that's actually a really epic storyline. And we've got, there's that sequence where they actually take this huge armada of S.H.I.E.L.D. agents and everything else out to, or is it Indochina, isn't it?
Yep.
No, Micronesia. And of course, find the whole place rigged to blow because the Skrulls have completely outwitted them. And we go from there. And I also love the fact that Thor seems to have a new power, which is this hammer can teleport.
Yeah.
Which we never had that in, or as far as I'm aware, didn't have that in the other Marvel universe as well.
No, he was always using via the Bifrost, wasn't he?
That's right, and that's how he would travel around, or he would fly, you know what I mean? So we've got this new teleportation thing going on, and of course, after Banner's little rampage halfway through, he's now incarcerated.
Yeah.
In a special cell that he designed to keep the Hulk under control. And the epic battle at the end is kind of where they finally pull together as a team. And it's taken us, 13 issues to get there, but we finally see them working as a team to bring this together and to bring down this Skrull threat.
One of my favorite moments where they finally do that as well is because it really shows you Cap's power as a tactician as well, which is something that's often, I think, undermined, and they certainly didn't play that up enough, I think, in the movie version of it, and perhaps they will in the film.
Yeah,
is that Cap is kind of the brains of the outfit as well. Like he can see every move five steps ahead, and he's got three backup plans. He said, "Are we on to backup plan number three yet?"
They actually make mention of that early on in the series when they first pull him in, and they say he's going to be. They say, "Is he okay for this?" He goes, "This man is the most brilliant tactician leader we've ever seen." You know.
Yeah.
So I love the fact that he actually says at one point, he goes, "I always have a plan."
Yeah. Well, there's all units fall back, prepare for weapon of last resort. Now, this is one of my favorite moments in the entire series. You've mentioned Banner was locked in a cage of his own creation for several issues.
Yeah.
Now, but they need him in the final battle to Hulk out. They achieve this. They can't get him. They beat him around for a while. Nothing's working. So they decide to throw him out of a plane.
Wasn't there actually a line where he says, "What if it doesn't work?" or something like that? He goes, "Well." it's just Banner.
But when he does land, Fury's like, "Hell of a thud for a 97-pound biologist." And then Hulk comes out and...
I love the fact that the Hulk actually talks as well. I mean, he's not just this brain-dead monster in this. He's a completely different person, but he always has something to say. I just love the way they've drawn him. He's just a monster. I mean,
it's like, what the hell does stupid blue man know about Betty Ross? Blue man tell Hulk or Hulk start squeezing head? Things like that.
I love him. I just love the fact that he's just tearing people apart.
Like, Hulk touched naked guy like naked guy was touching Betty. It's another one of my favorite lines. Naked guy went and made Hulk angry.
he actually says something when he bites off the head of the Skrull guy at the end. Oh, that's just right. Because the guy's the Skrull, even all torn apart, is still basically saying, "Well, my friend, it would appear that congratulations are in." And Hulk just goes, "Shut up!" Tears his head off.
Naked guy thought he was smart, but brains don't win fights. Banner had brains, and people walk all over Banner. Strong, the only one that counts. And Hulk, the strongest one there is.
He's great. I mean, he's just a. There's your Hulk straight line.
Straight line. Yeah. Hey, these guys called you a sissy, buddy boy. And he's like, "You really gonna let them get away with that?" "No, Hulk, not sissy boy. Hulk straight." And then Hulk proceeds to leap in the air.
Yeah, well, which has got
these giant Skrull ships.
Just take on everything. So, now, I love, we should go away from Hulk for a minute. There's this subplot running throughout the entire battle where they're trying to stop the Doomsday weapon, which is basically going to destroy the entire planet. And we've got Tony Stark in his armor ripping this Doomsday weapon out of a wall. And I just love this, that one line where we've got Tony before, it's Natasha, Black Widow. She goes, Tony, before you do this, I just wanted to say goodbye and let you know that I really always treasure that special moment we shared in the men's room back at the base. Yeah. That pre-battle relief really meant a lot to me, and I swear to you now that you shall always be honored for this sacrifice you're about to make. And he goes, huh? What sacrifice? And she immediately has assumed that he's going to, like, fly this thing up and sacrifice himself up to save. And he goes, no, that's not my plan at all. And then he goes, what? Don't be ridiculous. Do you think that I was going to be dragging this thing out of here?
My favorite subplot throughout this is Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch.
Okay, now I want to talk about that very quickly at the head of the show, because this is a really bizarre relationship that these two, they've crafted. They only touch on it in the first volume. In later volumes, in Volume 2 and Volume 3, we are basically assuming from the way it's written that they're having an incestuous relationship. And yeah, they are, because they are always in each other's arms. They're always laying in each other's laps. And all the other characters start making mention of it, going, this is kind of uncomfortable. That this brother and sister are always, like, fondling each other. And all this. It's a bizarre relationship.
What I love about it is that they keep turning up and saying things like, well, we did it. We saved that.
Yeah.
And they're saying, You didn't. We didn't see you at all. It's like, well, if you slow down the footage,
and they go, yeah, right.
And then it's like, after all this, and you've watched, like, you know, Hulk take down ships, you've watched Cap take down people, you've watched Tony Stark make a what we thought was going to be a sacrifice, but turned out to be just a really cool move. You've seen all this really cool stuff happening over this epic several issues, and then at the end, it's like they suddenly turn up. We've not seen them for 3 issues.
Yes.
Like, we did it. We saved the world, sister. And then it's like, what is it with you two? You weren't even around for the fight. Actually, if you slow down the satellite pictures of the attack, I think you'll find that Scarlet Witch and I is, oh, great, here we go again.
Yeah, exactly. And I think actually you will find in later volumes at some point they actually do go slow down some footage, and he is there. He is running around in the background. And it's these little details, this little world that they've created. So it's this lavish, beautiful world that they've created that has so much scope. And because they allow them, and after what you said about what Mark Millar said about the like an HBO series, it makes so much sense, because there's these moments that run throughout both this, the Ultimates series, so the Ultimates 1, 2, 3, and the Ultimate Avengers that followed it, where the Avengers are like a black ops team. They're like the non-public team that go off and do the dirty stuff, you know? Because it's actually after the events of, I think, Ultimates 3 that they decide they need that, because the Ultimates can't actually make a move without the world watching. So they need a covert team that can go in and do stuff where they don't necessarily want the world to be watching what they're doing, you know? I should offer a little spoiler as well, just because it's one of my favorite moments. And it's actually the thing that made me want to just leap into Volume 2. Is that in Volume 2, we actually get to a resolution onto the Thor question. We get a resolution of is he a god or isn't he? And it is, I'll just say that all you got to do is read it. I'm not going to tell you what happens, but in, I think it's issue 13 of the Ultimates Volume 2, it is awe-inspiring.
Okay.
It is just fantastic. And you sit there and go, okay, now there is no question. Because there's a lot of flashback scenes in Ultimates Volume 2, which actually shows him in the mental hospital, and they go and talk to the doctors and saying, is he all there? It's like, what's going on, you know? And so there is actually an answer to that that comes up. Also, the fact that one of the bad guys, and I think this is where the movie comes in, one of the bad guys in Ultimates 2 is Loki. And so Loki,
well, he references Loki.
Yeah. Well, he references all of them.
He said, oh, yeah, I was off this morning battling my evil brother Loki and something else. And sure you were.
And what's he say? At one point he says, I was battling the serpent of something.
Yeah.
And it's like, really? Yeah, okay, whatever. But yeah, so Loki makes his appearance in Ultimates Volume 2, and he's kind of in charge of what's going on and what's leading to all the badness. Ultimates Volume 2 is a good read. Also, gave us not just the 13 episodes, but it also had two annuals. So it was actually quite a big series, Volume 2. And what's really interesting is that Volume 3 was only like 5 issues. It was really short. They shortened Volume 3 right down into a very compressed little season. But overall, I got to say, loved it. Loved it, loved it, loved it, loved it much more the second time around. And I know why, because the second time around, I wasn't going, what the hell is this? This isn't my superheroes. The second time around, I was just enjoying the story. And enjoying it as just enjoying the story, it is damn good. It's a great piece of writing. It's a great piece of art.
So. It's great. And it's just like every issue ends with like a terrific line. I was just flicking through here, end of issue 4, you know, after the Hulk's been unleashed, and it's like the plan, and, you know, got things, just iconic scenes with Cap coming out going, the plan couldn't be any simpler, Tony. We just hit him till he drops. You know, just really, I mean, this, as you said, that artwork stays detailed throughout the whole thing. You've got these great hero shots throughout the whole thing. It's a beautiful series to look at art-wise. It's, the writing is tight. These are characters you want to spend time with. And as you said, I think part of the reason you wanted to move on to issue as volume 2 so quickly was that you actually, it wasn't just like a big event movie where at the end you kind of feel, wow, that was awesome, yeah, I will see that again, but you know, that was I loved that, and then if you went and saw it again it would be more of the same again. But this is because they've built up such great character detail throughout the whole thing, and you actually feel as though there's aspects of these characters you want to explore more. Or they've just been written so well that you actually want to spend an extra time with them, because they are fascinating. They're not just, you know, stereotypes of a superhero. They're really living human beings who happen to live in a superhero universe.
Can I throw out a weird statement? They're not just cartoon characters.
Exactly, though. I know it isn't a weird thing. They're really not. They do feel like real people that just happen to be drawn.
They're not bad. They're just drawn that way.
Drawn that way, yeah. That's what it needs. Does Jessica Rabbit turn up in Volume 3 at all?
Absolutely. All right, well, I'm going to recommend that. And I've got our book for next week, by the way.
Okay.
I've just finished reading it, actually. So, and I really want to talk about it. So I figured, well, what better forum to talk about it than here? And
you should actually, just give me my writing assignment then. My reading assignment.
So I'm going to give you your reading assignment. I'm sure you've already read it, but go back and read it again. And it is actually called Superman Secret Origin.
And it was the...
If you would think about it as a television show, it was basically the pilot for that Geoff Johns reboot of Superman back in, what was it, 2001, 2002, or whatever it was. Remember when he kind of rebooted the whole series? What's really interesting about it is that the artwork, they've actually drawn Superman to look just like Christopher Reeve.
That is interesting.
And I kept looking all the way through it. I'm going, boy, that looks like Christopher Reeve. That's kind of spooky. So I would actually suggest, I'm just going to make sure I am right about the writer on that. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. Give me one second. I'm just pulling up the issue right now, and that way I can actually look at it straight on the cover. What am I looking for? Secret Origin. The other one I want to do in Superman, by the way. Why is that not coming up? Superman... Secret Origin. Here it is. Superman Secret Origin.
It is Geoff Johns.
Yes, it is Geoff Johns. Yeah, it's. Remember, he was kind of responsible for rebooting the Superman series back it was 2009. Sorry, 2009, I think it was. November 2009 or something like that.
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, and he kind of, it was like the last reboot before, of course, the 52 came in, you know?
Was that the Birthright one you're talking about? No,
Secret Origin.
Oh no! I thought you meant the other reboot could have been Birthright.
Oh, I think that might have been Birthright. No, I was thinking of the reboot, the most recent reboot.
New
52 reboot. So this is this kind of launched us all into all of that, and it's very interesting because it literally is just the origin story of Superman, and it's the origin story of Superman. It goes into all the Smallville stuff. It goes into him meeting Lois, and it's him. It's all about Lex. It kind of gives a plausible reason why Lex might be mad, you know? It's not just about losing his hair. You know?
No, which is a reason to be mad.
Yeah, but not a
particularly when Superman's hair, like a strand of Superman's hair, can hold up, you know, several tons of weight.
Well, all right, fair enough. All right, so Secret Origins is a 6-issue miniseries. So that should be a nice, easy read for us.
Okay, so yeah, we're getting smaller. We've gone from 13 issues down to 6, which is nice.
And our last one was only 3.
We'll do all of Walking Dead the week after that.
Yeah, what the hell? I'm ready to do Walking Dead. I'm up to date.
I think we should do Walking Dead because I think we should start moving. I think what we need to do is do a few non-superhero.
I agree.
Comics.
I'd actually like to do Walking Dead, but the question is which one? Because Walking Dead is, I think, 80 something issues now.
Well, I've not read any of it, so if there's a nice first story arc.
Well, if you haven't read any of it, then it might be an interesting idea to go and we'll start from the beginning and get you to, because there are definite story arcs, but it is a continuation. It's like kind of like Lost. It just keeps going. You know what I mean? So I will have a look through them and I will see if I can pick us a nice story arc for you to go for. How's that sound?
Okay. That sounds good to me.
And while I'm doing that, we'll do Secret Origin. Because I am curious to know. I'm curious to talk about a few elements in this because I think it is a very straightforward retelling of Superman, but at the same time, they've modified it a little bit. But it also could there elements of this could be from the new film.
Okay,
I'm not saying that they are. I'm also reading Birthright at the moment, which is another one that could be an interesting one to have a look at. I'm kind of going through all these origin stories at the moment, trying to pin down what this movie is.
It could go either way. It could be.
There is actually another interesting series which we should also talk about. We could do this one instead, actually, if you wanted to. It's up to you. Have you read Superman Last Family of Krypton?
No, I haven't. The only one of those ones that you were suggesting is Birthright. It's the only one I've read.
Right, okay. So. Birthright's another one. And there's also Earth One, which is the J. Michael Straczynski one, which sounds very similar as well. So there's a few things kicking around. Last Family of Krypton's a fascinating one, though, because it's actually what if Lara, Jor-El, and Kal-El came to Earth? And basically the family was on Earth, and it's all about how Jor-El kind of starts remolding Earth in his image. You know, because it's like we're here to help. and it is actually interesting because it's kind of like a big what if. What if they all came, and how would that have changed things?
Yeah,
you know, and that is an interesting read as well. It's very much not the canon.
No, okay. Well, we'll do the Secret Origins one because I think it's a good place to start.
Okay, and then while we're doing Secret Origins this week, I'll have a look through Walking Dead. I'll see what I can figure out for it. Walking Dead is also very interesting to have a look at because season 2 is running on TV right now.
Sounds good.
So could be interesting. Could be topical. Could be topical.
Could be topical.
All right. Well, that brings us to an end, and we've run a little bit over again tonight. We've got to get better at this.
We do have to get better at this.
Anyway, Richard, where can people find more of you?
Oh God, I've forgotten.
It's so late at night, people.
it's very late. I watched 3 movies back to back at the cinema today.
Oh, you're a mess.
And I've come straight from that to this. So you can find me, given my love of film, on therealbits.com. That's IELLBits.com. It's a film website. And you can also find me on Twitter constantly, except for right now, because I'm about to fall off my chair, on DVD Bits.
I was about to say, you're just about to give yourself a plug and your volume just dropped.
Oh.
But they did hear you. It's okay. And you can find more of me just by hitting up geekactually.com, where you found this podcast. There's a follow us link on the side. You'll be able to find me all over the place. I'm on Google+, I'm on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter. Follow me at David McVeigh. Also wanted to stress that we do now have a Facebook page for Behind the Panels. Now we want to get one of those funky URLs where it's like, you know, facebook.com/behindthepanels. Wouldn't that be cool? That'd be nice and easy. We don't have it yet. You have to have at least 24 members you can get that. So we need all of you to go like our Facebook page right now. As soon as you hear this, just run over there.
Do like it. I mean, all we need is just a small fraction of our audience.
Absolutely. A small fraction of our audience. Go over it, like that page, and then we can get a funky old URL, and then we can start plugging the hell out of it. So
That sounds funky.
That does sound funky, doesn't it? So, and remember, you can always send email to us right now and tell us exactly what you thought of it. If you liked The Ultimates or you didn't like The Ultimates, we'd want to hear from you. All right? We want to hear what you had to say. Send that to comics@geekactually.com is our email address. We do have a voicemail line as well, 02-801-13167. I did that off the top of my head because I don't have it in front of me, so I hope it's right.
Look, whoever you do call, if that's not right,
just tell them
about this podcast.
Right. Tell them about the podcast and tell them to read The Ultimates. All right. So there you go. Richard, thank you very much. We'll do this again next week, huh?
It's been a pleasure as always, David.
It has been. And everybody, remember, go out and read Superman Secret Origin 6-issue miniseries, and we'll talk about that next week. Bye, Richard.
Bye, David.
See you later.
Some days you just can't get rid of a bomb.